Judaism. I am Heidi Schneider. And the session that I am teaching today, I think in some ways, for me, is the most difficult session I'll be teaching while I'm here for 2 weeks. I have called this one Lessons in Blood and Water. And the three rituals that I want to focus on today are rituals that I have to say are not without controversy in Jewish practice. And in fact, one of them, the mikveh practice, has basically disappeared except in the Orthodox community. And as we talk about it, I think that you may see why some of these practices are disappearing even among Jews. But I wanted to, one of the reasons I wanted to teach this class, aside from familiarizing you with some particularly beginning of life rituals, the Brit Milah and the baby naming of a girl, a Jewish girl, because some of you, has anyone in this room attended a bris of a boy, a Brit Milah ceremony? No, no one has. Okay. It's called in Yiddish, it's called a bris. It's a brit milah. It means covenant of the blood, actually, and it's the circumcision of a Jewish boy. I obviously invited a number of non-Jews to my son's brit milah, and it's a powerful experience, both for Jews, but I think particularly for non-Jews, because it is so alien. So I wanted to talk about that. The mikveh ceremony is, I think you will find it very familiar, because I believe probably the sacrament of baptism arises out of the Jewish practice of mikveh. And as I've told you, this is the very practice that's dying away in Judaism. So it's interesting that this has become a central part of Christianity, and it's really fading very much into the background in Jewish practice. But it is a beautiful ceremony, and I wanted to talk about that. And it's meaningful to me because anyone who converts to Judaism goes through a mikveh. So to some extent, you might think, oh, it's like a baptism, but it's really not. It's an ancient Jewish ritual that has to do with the laws of family purity, but it is also used in the conversion process. And then thirdly are the practices related to burial of the dead and treatment of the bereaved family following death, which also have to do with water and to some extent blood. So I want to talk about these powerful symbols, ancient symbols of blood and water, and how Jewish practice deals with those things. So first of all, let's start out with something that's perhaps a little bit easier, and that's the circumcision ceremony, or the bris, as it is called in Yiddish, and most commonly called. This is the time when a baby boy becomes a Jew. A baby girl is considered a Jew from birth, but a baby boy becomes Jewish when he has his bris ceremony. And it is generally held on the eighth day after the child's birth, assuming that the birth was normal and the baby is healthy and that sort of thing. If your baby has some problems and is in the hospital, this of course can be delayed until a pediatrician determines that it's okay for the baby to have a Brit Milah. The bris is considered the sign of the covenant between God and Abraham. And so the circumcision practice is absolutely central to Judaism. During the Holocaust, I talked to people who grew up in Poland and in Eastern Europe and survived the Holocaust, who talked about being so surprised when American and British soldiers would use the same restrooms with them. This is the first opportunity they ever saw to see someone who wasn't Jewish who was circumcised. Because, of course, in the American and British culture, circumcision is actually just kind of a medical practice that was instituted, and it wasn't a religious practice. But so for centuries, you could always tell kind of the Jews from the non-Jews, especially men, of course, because of the fact that they were circumcised. And these days, some Jewish families decide not to go through the Brit Milah because it is a ceremony that they consider somewhat barbaric, maybe There's always this controversy about female circumcision in Africa. It was only a step further to go and say, isn't this barbaric to do this kind of thing to a baby boy? And so I know a lot of Jewish families who have a circumcision done in the hospital at the same time as everybody else's babies would be circumcised, and they don't necessarily schedule a ritual around it. I would still say that that's relatively rare in Jewish practice, because the bris is considered such a central thing. This is what ties us to Abraham. This is what ties us to that original time that God said, you know, this shall be a sign upon your bodies, that you are my people. And you'll remember Abraham did this on himself. I don't know if you remember that or not. He did it as an adult on himself. And he did it not Isaac. Isaac, I think, had a Brit Milah at 8 days. But it was Ishmael, his older son, who was a teenager, I believe, at the time that his father performed his circumcision on him. And everyone in Abraham's household was circumcised at the same time. So they did it as adults. It's much more traumatic. But baby Isaac probably had his Brit Milah on the eighth day. The ceremony of the Brit Milah is actually fairly quick. It's about a 15-minute ceremony. The baby is brought in by an honored person in the household. In our family, it was my father. There is always an empty chair in the room where the Brit Milah happens, and that is the chair for Elijah the prophet. And if any of you have been attending my sessions, Elijah seems to come up every day. Elijah is deemed in Judaism to be the person who will bring in the Messiah. So at Passover, you set a cup. Some families set a place for Elijah at the table. Every Saturday night when we do our Havdalah service to conclude Shabbat, we sing a song to Elijah, inviting Elijah to come. And at the Brit Milah, we set a chair, usually draped with some beautiful fabric, maybe a talis, a prayer shawl, a special honor chair for Elijah. And that is, again, because anytime we have a grand ceremonial occasion, we want to remind ourselves that we always hope that the Messiah will be present, that Elijah will be there to answer our questions and herald in the Messiah. So there will be an Elijah's chair, and no one will sit in it, because we're saving it for Elijah. Then the actual circumcision takes place after a few prayers have been said by someone called a moil. The moil can be a rabbi, or the moil can, more likely in modern times, the moil is going to be a pediatrician who is Jewish and who has been, who is familiar with the prayers, and that person may lead the ceremony for the family. We had, in our family, we have lots of doctors. We have lots of OBGYNs, and so we had two moils, the baby's grandfather, my father-in-law, and my brother-in-law. So we had, we were very well taken care of in my son's Brit Milah. Wine is always a central part of any kind of Jewish ceremony, a drinking of a cup of wine. And at the Brit Milah, the baby is generally given a taste of wine before the circumcision takes place. This is both sacred, and I think it's considered supposedly a calming thing. It's not a big glug of wine, because we've got an 8-day-old infant. But what is traditional is to dip a handkerchief, a cotton ball, you know, some piece of little sponge in the wine, and allow the baby to suck on that while the Brit Milah ceremony takes place. And then the baby is circumcised, and then a number of prayers are said. The baby's generally handed back to the mother at that point, or the father, and then a number of prayers are said. I have brought along, because I guess I'm at that kind of life stage where lots of my friends are having children. So I have lots and lots of ceremonies that I have collected over the last couple of years from cousins and friends, and I even have my son's Brit Milah ceremony in here. And I'm just going to pass these around, and you can take a look at them. Not all of these are brisses, by the way. Some of these are baby namings for girls. And girl baby namings do not take place on the eighth day. They're traditionally done at the new moon ceremony, which is called Rosh Chodesh. So it's typically, you know, within a month after the baby girl is born. Again, there is no specific timeline for girls like that eighth, that magical eighth day for boys. So you can hold it really at any time, but traditionally people wait until the next new moon to hold their ceremony for their daughters. And the ceremony you see is very similar. If you look at these, you can see the girl ceremonies are not so different from the boy ceremonies, except for this drawing of the blood, which is central to the Brit Milah. The one thing I did want to say is that kind of the structure of the ceremony is really left, that 15-minute ceremony is the very short one and the very powerful one. I don't mean to minimize it at all. Hearing the cry of the baby is a, you know, for any parent, it's just one of those moments that you think, oh, you know, how can we be doing this? And yet I think that is the power of this ceremony too. It gets you right here. And it's ancient, and it's gone on forever and ever. And many of the people in the room have been through this. And it's very traditional for an older member of the family to come to the mother, and the polite thing of that family member to say is, "Your son's loss is our gain." In other words, is our community's gain, because we've gained another member of our family. But I wanted to say that at the end of our service, and anybody could do this, I mean, people do different things at the end of their services. My son's name is Asher Mendel, and I'll talk a little bit about baby namings, because boys are named at their brises and girls are named at their bat shalom ceremonies, as they're called. It's traditional in Jewish practice to name a child after a deceased family member. And that's why, I don't know if any of you noticed this or not, but it's really rather rare to hear of a Jewish junior. You won't very often hear of a Jewish child named after a living parent or any living person. Now, there's an exception, and that is Sephardic Jews, and these are Jews that trace their ancestry to primarily the Middle East, Africa, to some extent from Spain, Italy, so that part of the Mediterranean. Sephardic Jews have some different ritual practices than the Ashkenazi, who were the Eastern European Jews. And in the Sephardic culture, it's okay to name your child after a living relative. But in Ashkenazi culture, which is what my husband comes out of, his family traces itself back to Eastern Europe, it's in fact called a curse. If someone wants to curse you, they will say, "May a child soon be named after you," because that means you're no longer with us. In our family, Mendel comes from Asher's great uncle, who had been killed in a car accident rescuing another person who had gone off the road in a snowstorm the winter before. And he was a loving member of our family, and one of the first people, actually, I have to say, to welcome me into my husband's family. So he meant a lot to me, and so we named our son Asher Mendel after Marcel, Uncle Marcel. And the name Asher in Hebrew means blessed or fortunate, and you hear it a lot. The word Asher is used a lot in Hebrew prayers. It also happens to be the, I think it's a conjunction, I should know my grammar better, it means that. So Asher can mean that, but as a noun it means blessed or fortunate. And we felt very fortunate having our son, because I'd had a number of miscarriages before I got pregnant with him, and I wasn't at all certain I was ever going to have a child. And so we felt so fortunate, we named him Asher. It turns out now that he is also an extremely happy child, if any of you have met him. He really has a very happy spirit, so it was a perfect name for him. And in our ceremony, we have at the end the first psalm, which begins with the word Asher, which is happy the man that hath not walked in the counsel of the wicked. And that's very traditional, is to find what's called a pasuk, or a Bible verse that has your child's name in it, if you can find that, to read as part of the ceremony. So we read it in English, but happy, the first psalm begins with the word happy, which was Asher. Yes?
I just had a quick question. Is it customary for the mother and the father to choose a name for the child, or is it more of like a larger family decision?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think it's probably the parents who do, although we're expecting another child, and a lot of the names have been taken. There are a lot of cousins in this family, so a lot of the deceased family member names have been taken already, and so I have consulted with my in-laws about other names, kind of going back in the family tree, and we've gone back several generations, and I'm actually not too happy with some of those names. Maybe we'll end up repeating.
So it's not necessarily like the mother's side of the family as opposed to the father's side?
They can, yeah, sometimes, but you see, my family is, my background is not Jewish.
Right.
So we don't have that history of kind of those lovely biblical names in my family, and I'm also very fortunate that my parents are still both living, so I don't have to make that choice. And I had a grandmother I was very, very close to named Florence, who I wanted, if this baby were a girl, which it is not, I wanted to name the child Bluma, which is the Yiddish word for flower. So I would have named it after my grandmother if it had been a girl, but we're going to have another boy, and so we'll probably name it after someone on my husband's side. But just, it's just kind of, but very often families are invited to participate in the choice. I'd say more often than not, they are not, and therefore there's the same anxiety perhaps that there is in Christian families about why did they choose that name? That is the weirdest name.
When did your baby get its name at birth?
Because you really almost can't get a baby out of the hospital anymore without having a name on the birth certificate. But it's tradition in really observant families, the name is not used on the child until the circumcision.
In Norway, for example, a baby does not have its name until it's baptized.
Until it's baptized, right.
Well, it's similar. I mean,
it's just baby.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Do you have a question, sir?
I would assume that if you're choosing these names, like any other culture, they're somewhat unusual to the people around you. So do they go by that name, or do they, this will be your name, but we'll call you Nick? I mean, it's kind of one of those things.
Oh, yeah, people do that.
So you have...
Yes.
You'll take part of your name, or you'll give them some other name, or
right. Sometimes people have a Hebrew name and an English name.
Like your son.
Very, very common. Well, Asher is a Hebrew name.
So he goes by Asher.
He goes by Asher, okay. Right? But there might be someone who's uncomfortable with a biblical name like that, or considers it to be too Jewish, and they don't really want that, and so they might name him Andrew, but his Hebrew name would be Asher. So it's okay. Typical to name to take an anglicized name with the same letter, but that's not always true. We had a we have a ceremony at our synagogue when children begin their Jewish education, kind of in kindergarten or first grade, and they get a little tiny Torah scroll, and they come up on the bima, which is the altar area. And I remember our rabbi was reading the list of names, and there was this little boy, I think his name was Isaac, and he said Yitzhak, which would be Hebrew for Isaac. He said, and next is Yitzhak Stein. I mean, I don't really remember his name. And this little boy stands up and he says, "My name is Natan." So in this case, the family had given him the name Isaac, but his Hebrew name was Natan. I mean, but the rabbi made, I think, what would be considered a natural mistake, because Isaac sounds like a Jewish name, but it was just kind of amusing. I want to talk about a couple of concepts of the Brit Milah before I open it up to any other questions on this particular topic. And it has to do with kind of explaining the controversy about how male circumcision can be justified in this day and age. And there are a number of concepts that go on behind it. One is that the process of inflicting some kind of pain on a very young infant requires the parents to go through an entire letting go process. And as a mother, I can tell you this is absolutely true. And especially as a mother who was not steeped in Jewish tradition, this was a really difficult ceremony for me. And there's no question my son was going to be circumcised, but it was still a very, very difficult decision. And that letting go process led me to the understanding that ultimately this child is not mine. This child belongs to God. And that's what this ceremony is about. That's what this dedication is about. This rite of circumcision, this drawing of the blood is a dedication to God. That's what it was meant way back when God said to Abraham, I want you to do this. I want the symbol of this blood is what ties the two of us together. The other is that, and we can't get around this, it's only a male ceremony, and it only has to do with the male sex organ, with the penis. And so I think that automatically ties it into the relationship of the husband, the father, and the son, who, you know, of course, the father has gone through this before. It's a connectedness to them, and it's a reminder that this child will grow himself to be a father, hopefully, and that he in turn will be a grandfather, and that all of this comes out of the male generative organ, which is what this ceremony is about. And then there are others, I think probably anthropologists, who say that this is as close as fathers are ever going to get to the birth experience themselves, so that the Brit Milah is in some ways a ritual for fathers. The mothers, of course, have gone through all the blood and the water already in the actual labor process, but the father has not had that experience. The blood and the pain of watching your child being circumcised is the father's. It's the father's turn to go through that same kind of experience. And lastly, I have to say that blood, and this is why I call this session Blood and Rituals in Blood and Water, blood is considered extremely sacred in the Jewish faith. Much of the system of kashrut, or keeping kosher, or eating in a ritually Jewish way, has to do with making sure that you are not eating blood. And if you do have to eat blood, i.e. you're eating meat, that you do it in very circumscribed fashion. And Jews are forbidden to eat any organ meats because those are considered to have too much blood in them. And kosher meat is always salted so that as much blood is taken out as possible. And so therefore, the Brit Milah, also there is this sanctity of the... And you know, the Brit is not like a terribly bloody ceremony. It really is just a few drops of blood. But again, it's that tying, the whole idea of blood is tied together in a number of Jewish rituals, starting with this very one. And it's carried out in the way we eat on a day-to-day basis. And as I will tell you, I'll mention it now, but when we get to Tahara, or the burial of the dead, it's also part of Jewish custom that if a person has died in a way that caused their clothes to become bloody, or some of their blood was left on their clothing when they died, they are to be buried with that clothing, not wearing it. They're wearing something else, but they are buried with that clothing that still has the blood on it, because the idea is that you stay together with your blood. And again, it's that trying to treat blood in a sacred fashion. Are there any questions about Brit Milah? Let's move on to the mikveh. And I'm really kind of moving into an area that I don't know much about, because I do not practice the laws of family purity, which I'm going to be discussing with you. But it's absolutely fascinating, and it's still practiced probably, I'm going to guess, by 25% of Jews in the Orthodox community would probably practice what I'm talking to you about right now, the laws of family purity. And these have to do with a woman's menstrual cycle. These are all embarrassing things to talk about. So I said this session was going to be the hardest. But again, here we have it, rituals of blood and water. Anybody who has read the Hebrew Bible knows that there is a lot of discussion about being clean and being unclean. And there's some very difficult tasks for feminists dealing with when a woman is deemed unclean and when a woman is deemed clean. And so these laws of family purity arise out of these passages in Leviticus and I believe Deuteronomy, but I think it's mostly Leviticus are where these passages arise, which regulate. So the practice of family purity is biblical based. It's not Talmudic. It didn't arise later. Just like Brit Milah comes out of the Bible. And the practice of family purity comes out of these ancient verses in the Bible that regulate when you can have sex and when you can't. A mikvah is a ritual bath. And in any Jewish community, it is typically one of the very first things that will be put in because it has to do with family purity. Before a woman can have sex with her husband after her menstrual cycle, she needs to dedicate herself in the ritual bath, which is called the mikveh. And before a synagogue will go up in an observant Jewish community, the mikveh will be built first. It's even said that if the community is so poor that they don't have the money to build the mikveh, they must sell their Torah scroll in order to raise the money for a mikveh. So this is, it's obviously a very, very important part of observant ritual practice. This practice of waiting, a time period of abstinence from having sex is called the nidah. And there are basically three rituals that are assigned to women. And it is the nidah, this act of family purity, this going to the mikveh and refraining from sex during a certain period of time. The ritual of lighting candles on Shabbat was traditionally assigned to women. And the third one was the ritual of taking challah, which is also associated with Shabbat. When you make your ritual bread, beautiful braided bread for Shabbat, you are always required to take a small portion of the dough and burn it in the oven that you're baking your bread in, which is a memory of the portion that you would always save for the priests, for the kohanim. Whenever you brought a sacrifice to the temple, you always brought something for the kohanim as well. We don't have the temple practice anymore, so the woman is required to take a bit of dough from a challah bread in memory of that gift that would be given to the kohanim. So it, again, it's a very important ritual practice for women because it's one of the three assigned ritual tasks that women are given, especially in Judaism. The mikveh, by the way, as I mentioned earlier, is also used in the conversion process. So my only encounter with them, I have had two encounters with the mikveh. One was at my wedding, because again, it's very traditional for Jews to go to use, and men and women both will use a mikveh before their wedding, again as a symbol of starting fresh, of dedicating themselves to a new life together. And so I went through the mikveh before my wedding, on my wedding day, but also in the process of conversion. Both men and women go through a mikveh after their studies, and it's a really beautiful, it was a beautiful experience. You go through the mikveh, male or female, and then you return, in our practice anyway, you return back to the synagogue where you are given your Hebrew name, and a blessing is said in front of the Torah. So the ark is open where the Torahs are kept, and you're allowed to take out the Torah and hold it for the first time. And you're given your Hebrew name, and a number of prayers are said. So it's part of this larger ceremony of the actual conversion process. Now, for a woman who's converting, the only step she needs to take is, well, aside from rather extensive study, is to go through the mikveh. That's actually when she becomes Jewish. For a man, however, he has to undergo a circumcision if he hasn't been circumcised already. So again, we have this ritual of blood and water. Most men, actually, today are circumcised already. So what happens is that a drop of blood is pierced. Penis is pierced and a drop of blood is taken. Usually this is done in a doctor's office. It's part of the practice. I think it's still probably more women convert than men just because of this very, very process. I mean, it's difficult. It's a real, I talk to men who have converted and it's difficult. There's no way to minimize it. It's not that it's necessarily very painful, and they do get anesthesia. It's still the thought of doing that. And we get right back to this whole controversy about, you know, these practices get you where it hurts. I mean, you have to think about it. You have to be really committed to go ahead with it. But that's what's required. I've mentioned Masada a number of times in my sessions here, and I don't know if you have heard the story about what happened at Masada. A number of Jews escaped Jerusalem while it was under siege by the Romans. They were considered a radical sect of Jews, and they ran off to the desert and lived on this incredible mountain with a very, very flat, I call it a mesa, but I don't think that's quite, it looks like a mesa, I don't think that's quite what it is, in the middle of the desert. And they managed to survive there for about 3 years before the Roman siege eventually got to them. And they, in the end, opted to commit suicide as a group rather than let the Romans take them prisoner. A lot of excavations have been done in Israel at the Masada site. It's a fascinating place. A lot of kids go there to have their bat or bar mitzvahs. It's just it's a central tourist attraction in Israel if you go there. You will undoubtedly go to Masada at some point. But one of the things they discovered when they were digging out Masada was a mikvah. And there it is. It's right in the central square, and it's a huge basin. Quite magnificent, actually. It's at least as big as this fireplace, and I think actually it could be as big as this room, although I may be exaggerating somewhat. And it's got steps, many steps. I'm thinking about 20 steps coming down into it below the center of town. The way it's excavated right now, it kind of looks like it's out in the open, but I'm sure it was probably in a tent or it was enclosed in some way, because obviously the ritual of being in a mikvah, you have to undress yourself completely, immerse your entire body a number of times in the water, and that would be a very private ceremony. So it had to be fully enclosed. But it was interesting to me that here on top of this mesa in the middle, and they're under siege for 3 years by the Romans, where the heck were they getting enough water to fill up this giant basin? And yet the ritual of mikvah, nidah, was so crucial that they couldn't continue to have sex, they couldn't continue to have children unless they had a mikvah. And so there, it's actually bigger than the synagogue at Masada. It's very, very interesting. So if you go to Masada, you will not be able to miss the mikvah, and you'll see it. They will call it, I think on your tour, they will call it the public bath. Do not let this deceive you. This is a polite way. It's not a bath. A mikvah is never, never a bath. You have to be totally clean to go through a mikvah. It was not a public bathing. That's what the Romans did. That's not what the Jews did. It was a ritual bath, and it was used by women monthly. It was used by men probably before their marriages, before the high holy days. Very often, men will go to dedicate themselves for the new year. There might be other special occasions in which a man decides that he wants to go through a mikvah, so it would be used by everyone. There is also a practice in some Orthodox community of dedicating when you've made a kosher home, and let's say you have either made your dishes kosher or you have new dishes that you're going to bring into your kosher home, to dedicate those dishes and silverware and whatnot as well. So you can also put the dishes and the silver and whatnot in the mikvah as well. And that might have been what the mikvah at Masada was used for. In order to have a mikvah, it's supposed to come from fresh running water. So the perfect places for a mikvah would be a river or a stream or a spring. A lake would work. But it's not always possible to do that. So the rabbis came up with different ways of being able to create a mikvah, but it must always have its source in some sort of live running water from a living source. And I think of the stories of John the Baptizer, you know, bringing people to the lake and having them immerse themselves. And it wasn't a new concept. This was something that had been done before. It hadn't been called baptism. It had been called mikvah. But I think what happened when that ritual became part of early Christianity, it was opened up, you can see, from just women and just related to sexual purity to man. I mean, it became really a different kind of concept. But basically, this dedication in a lake would have been just the perfect kind of mikvah. Obviously, in a place like Masada, they had to haul the water up there, and it wasn't fresh. And so I suppose the rabbis just said, this is what we have to do under the circumstances. We can't have fresh water.
This woman would have to be a virgin, right?
Pardon me?
This woman would have to be a virgin.
What woman?
That was being baptized for this mikvah.
No, because you do it every month. You don't have to. I mean, I'll put it this way. You probably go to the mikvah for the first time as a young woman on your wedding day. And presuming you would be presumed to be a virgin. And so you go through the mikvah at that time. And then thereafter, you would go on a monthly basis, because it really is tied to marriage and to sex. Young unmarried women probably are not using a mikvah, because it's only related to what you know, your period of abstinence. And let me talk a little bit about that. It would begin, the biblical origin is that it begins on the first day of your period, and you count 7 days. And that's what the Bible says, is that a woman is, quote, unclean for 7 days. And I need to talk about the word unclean. When it's used that way in the Bible, it doesn't mean dirty or filthy or unkept at all. What it is meant is that the person who is unclean, male or female, is someone who can't be in the sacred premises of the temple itself. And that is, again, because what was going on at the temple? Shedding of blood, right? It was human sacrifice. I mean, human. It was animal sacrifice back in the ancient temple days. And so the whole beginning ritual of Judaism had to do with the shedding of blood of a pure animal as part of worship of God. And so you had to be ritually pure. And if you weren't ritually pure, you were called unclean. So I hate the word unclean, but if you understand it in kind of a liturgical sense, I think it's easier to grasp. So the Bible set forth 7 days. The rabbis set forth approximately 12 days. And so there's this period of abstinence where an Orthodox man and a woman will not sleep together. They will have separate beds. They won't touch each other, typically. Again, this depends on the observance that they have. And they will separate themselves from one another for 12 days. And then on the 12th day, the woman will go to the mikvah, and she will dedicate herself in the mikvah. And that night, assuming that evening is when they will be resumed to have sexual relations again. Now, there are a number of interesting things about how this works. And Blue Greenberg, who is an Orthodox rabbi's wife and an Orthodox feminist, it may sound like a contradiction in terms, but she writes very feelingly about these rituals. And I read her chapter again this morning about Nidah, and why she does it, and why she thinks it's important. And she said, Nidah is a combination of holiness, and it's a combination of hardship. And for the way she looks at it, practicing this all the time, is that there are a number of benefits to it. She feels that, one, it's showing, and she said, Nidah, you must always understand, is not just a woman's thing, it's a man's thing too. It's a family thing. Because if your husband doesn't believe in Nidah, there's going to be problems in the family. So it has to be an agreement between husband and wife when they marry that they want to involve themselves in the laws of ritual family purity practice. And the man has to abstain as well as the woman. So it really is a partnership. And she talks a lot about the practice of Nidah being a partnership and understanding your partnership in a way that is separate from sexual desire. Because during that 12 days, when you abstain from touching and holding and having sexual intercourse with one another, there have to be other ways that you find to keep your marriage spark. And she said, in Orthodox households, people will leave messages for one another and one another's pillows, or they will, you know, they will, she said, there are other ways that you convey love to someone during that 12-day period. You find ways to connect during that period that aren't physical. And in some ways, that she finds that, that while it is a hardship, it's also a holy act that takes place. She says going to the mikveh ties her to centuries and generations of other women. And she says, as I'm sitting there waiting to enter the mikveh, and I'm saying the prayers in my head, I realize that my ancestors for centuries have been doing this, and I am connected all the way back probably to Sarah in doing this practice. And it's extremely overwhelming to think about the fact that this is something that has connected me to women throughout the ages. She talks about the fact that, in particularly in contemporary society, it seems a lot of times that sex can become an issue of control and manipulation. And to some extent, having the process of nidah or abstinence takes away some of that, maybe not all of that, from a couple. Because in fact, what she says happens is it enhances sexual desire when you are forced throughout, you know, regularly on a monthly basis, not to touch, not to kiss, not to hold one another for a 12-day or longer period, depending on the woman's cycle. That by the time she has gone through the mikveh, it is an evening of rejoicing. It is a time of great celebration for the couple to come back together again. It's a real bonding. She ties it also to fertility. And I think there may be a part of this as well, that if you think about how this cycle works, if you begin to have intercourse and you haven't for 12 days, and you begin to have it 12 days after your cycle began, for many women, that's going to be almost right at the peak of their fertility cycle. And so she believes that maybe there's been some of that too, that the woman is fertile at that point, she's ready, and the man is ready. And so so it's more likely to increase the population if the two of them come together at that time. I have talked to friends who use the laws of family purity, who practice nidah, and who have had trouble conceiving. And there, I should let you know that it doesn't always work perfectly. 12 days is sometimes past some women's cycles, and or 14 days, or however long it may be. And it is possible for rabbis to grant dispensations to families where women have different kinds of cycles, in order to enable them to become pregnant. So while maybe the ideal is that that's the peak fertility, it isn't always true for everybody. And so so accommodations can be made based on people's special kind of physical needs in that way. And the last time that the mikveh is traditionally used is after childbirth. And there's a period of time that a woman waits after childbirth to enter the mikveh again. She is supposedly not having any intercourse during that time period. The time period is 14 to 21 days, and frankly, I think most doctors today are telling women not to have intercourse during that time period anyway, because it's hard on the body. But again, you can see that that is tied, again, our rituals of blood and water, because after childbirth, of course, there's been a lot of blood that has been expelled, and so that you wait this period of time after the birth of the child before you go to the mikveh. This is kind of an interesting story. I wanted to go to the mikveh after the birth of my son, mostly because I was so grateful that I'd had a normal birth and I'd had a normal child, and I thought that this would be a wonderful way to kind of start out my new life as a mother. And the mikveh in our community is run only by the Orthodox, and I'm a conservative Jew, and it's really rather difficult for people who aren't following the laws of family purity and who aren't showing up there on a monthly basis to get in. in our community, and so I was unable to schedule a time to get in to the mikveh. And I tried a number of, and it was there were a number of Jewish holidays that fell in the middle of it all, and I never did it. So, but I wasn't doing it as part of the law of family purity, fortunately. I was just doing it because I wanted to dedicate myself to new motherhood afterwards. But it's been kind of my personal pitch in my community that I think that the conservative movement should be building more mikvahs, because there are more and more people converting to Judaism, and there are people who I think would use the mikvah to dedicate themselves at particular important life cycle events, if it were more accessible. And it's just not so accessible when it's being used regularly. And I think it should be. The priority should go to people who are using it, laws of family purity. Yes, Corey.
When you were married before, what mikveh did you use? Or is that common amongst conservative Jews to go through mikveh before?
No. I don't know. I guess I don't know. It would depend on their level of observance. I was married in a conservative synagogue in Des Moines, Iowa, and they had a very close affiliation with the only other. Des Moines has three synagogues, and one is Reform, and one is conservative, and one is Orthodox, and it's a nice community. The people are really, they help one another a lot, so it was not difficult to get into the Orthodox mikveh in Des Moines. Because it's a small Jewish community, and so people just help each other out. But Minneapolis, St. Paul has a much, much larger Jewish community, and they only have two mikvahs for the entire Jewish community, one in St. Paul and one in Minneapolis. So it really is very, very difficult to get in, because there are many more Orthodox Jews in Minneapolis than there are in Des Moines. Any other questions?
While we're talking about that, getting into the mikvah, mm-hmm. I presume that includes scheduling the services of the rabbi?
No. You don't. To convert, you need a rabbi.
For example, after childbirth?
No. The mikvahs are run by people of the same sex that you are, for obvious reasons. And so there are women who handle the mikvah, and they... they will hold up a sheet. So someone is present always when you use a mikveh, but they hold up a sheet or a big towel in front of their face so they can't see you when you're entering the... It's a deep pool. I'm trying to remember how deep it is. It seems to me it kind of comes up to about chest level. And then you immerse yourself and you say a blessing. And that person is there to witness the blessing, and they will say amen at the end of the blessing, and then you immerse yourself two other times, and you have to be completely, completely immersed. And then you come out, and this person will wrap you, this woman, if you're a woman, or the man will wrap you in a towel, and then you can go off. So the only time that a rabbi would be present was for my mikveh when I converted, and he was in a separate ante room, and he was just there, you know, so that the woman who watched my mikveh said, she said the blessing, you know, so he knew that it had been done correctly. Yes.
Was this a decision that you and your husband made, whether you would follow the laws of family purity, or because he was conservative, it just was not considered?
You mean whether we would or would not?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think it would not be.
You know, this just wasn't appealing to me at all. I mean, I had studied it. I'd studied it in the course of my studies, but it never, to me, seemed like a really great idea.
And it could be entirely up to you. There wasn't any pressure. Orthodox, it probably would have been.
It would be much less of a choice, because it'd be difficult to find a spouse, perhaps.
Uh-huh.
But as Blue Greenberg put, she said, you know, the laws of family purity are entirely secret. You don't know what people are doing in their, you know, you really don't know what people are doing in their private lives or not. I suppose you see who's in the mikveh with you every week, or I mean every month, but you don't necessarily really know what's going on in between. And so, that's why I say I don't know how many people actually follow the laws of family purity strictly, but I don't know of any conservative Jews who do it. And that's why they don't have mikvahs. In fact, I think it's kind of discouraged in some ways. It's considered know, it's just not considered something that should be done. But I really, I've read Blue Greenberg's book. I have friends who are Orthodox, and I do understand part of it. I see why this still survives in their community, because I can understand that maybe it is true that it actually builds the marriage, that there are, you know, that period of abstinence might in fact strengthen marriage to some extent. But I haven't, you know, it was not a choice that we really came up with. Yeah.
Can you schedule it that you can be there for this baby?
I should probably start now. Yeah, I could, and I might try it again, because I just haven't visited the Mikvah in a while, and it would be a...
As a Roman Catholic, you married a Jew, I take it.
Well, I was Jewish by the time I married him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
And you mentioned burying of the dead.
Yes.
He's put in a white sheet, is that?
Yes, thank you. That's a good transition. That's the last ritual I wanted to talk about is Jewish, traditional Jewish burial. And this, I will say, is done more across the community. Conservatives do this as well as Orthodox. Reform, I don't know. I just can't tell you. I don't know. I think it's probably the conservative and the Orthodox that do this.
I can tell you, in Norway, you're buried in a white sheet.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have your normal clothes.
That's right. And that's true in Jewish practice too, that in traditional Jewish practice, that you are wrapped in a white sheet. And if you want, you can be buried in your tallis, your prayer shawl, which I've shown some of you before, in order to make sure that the fringes on the tallis are cut off when the person is deceased. So it's no longer... It can no longer be used for prayer, but the person may be wrapped in their tallis, but you're absolutely right that you're wrapped in a white sheet. But what happens before that is really quite a beautiful ceremony. The person is bathed. It's called a met. A dead body is called a met in Hebrew, and the person who has deceased is taken to a funeral home, but usually it's a funeral home for Jewish people. And they are bathed by a group of other Jews. Now, the body is bathed. It's a very, very careful process. The body is never turned face down. The whole body is washed in water. The hair is washed. The body is totally cleaned. All the orifices are cleaned out. Prayers are said at various points during the cleaning process. And after that happens, the person is wrapped in white. And tallis is put on. There is no embalming in traditional Jewish practice, and therefore the burial of the dead takes place rather quickly. This group of people that bathes the dead or practices tahara, as it's called, is called the Hevra Kedisha. It means the Hevra comes from the word that Dan was talking about this morning, Hesed. It's a blessing to prepare the dead for burial. And those people have to be on call like that, because typically you try to bury someone who is Jewish within 24 hours if you can. If you can't, 48 hours. They try not to go longer than that. So you want to do this ritual bathing very early, as early on in the process you can. So you have to gather, you know, 5 to 6 people to do the tahara. They are always of the same sex, so there will be a female burial society and there will be a male burial society. The other part of Jewish tradition is that you never leave a mat by itself until it's buried. And so you try always to have someone with the body in the funeral home, and people who do that process, and I have done that. I'm hoping someday to be trained in tahara, but with a small child, it's really hard to be available all the time, which you really need to do to be part of the society. So for the time being, I make myself available as what is called a shomer or a guard. And you can again be called in the middle of the night, but there's more time to schedule to go and sit with the body from the time that it's dead until the time that it is buried. And what you do is you go and you sit for a period of time and you read psalms or other meditative literature that you want, and you just make sure that the body is always accompanied. And I think that that's a beautiful part of our tradition as well. Taking care of the bereaved family is also a big part of Jewish practice. And after after a person has died and there is a funeral ceremony, at the funeral, the family will tear part of their garment. If they're Orthodox, they will actually tear their clothes. So they may wear a dress with a shirt over it and tear the shirt. In less observant circles, people will have a ribbon. It's usually a black ribbon that they tear, and they wear the ribbon for the next 7 days. So the first part of bereavement is the tearing of the garment, and that's, you know, a symbol of that tremendous grief that just makes you want to bare your chest. That tearing process happens. And then a memorial candle is lit for the person who is deceased, and that candle is basically kept burning for the next 7 days. After the period of 7 days of mourning, a candle will be lit every year on that person, the day that person died, and that's called a yahrzeit. It's a Yiddish word, meaning the anniversary. And so you remember that person every year on the anniversary of their death with a memorial candle that you light, and usually go to synagogue and say prayers for them on that day. During the Shiva period, which is the 7 days of mourning, the mirrors in the home of the bereaved family are covered as a sign of grief. People bring food and come to their home. They are not expected to leave their home for 7 days. This is not observed by everybody, but I wish it were. I've been to so many Shivas, and I see that the healing process that goes on in that seven-day period, and it forces the community to come to you. Food is brought to the family so they don't have to cook. People try to be in the house as much as possible, but they also set times for the family to be alone so they can rest and sleep and just be together. A lot of healing takes place between family members during Shiva, because sometimes people are in far-flung places and there have been hard feelings, and everybody comes together for 7 days and may stay in the same house. It's, again, a very, very, very powerful experience. And I talked in my first class about the mourner's Kaddish, the prayer that the bereaved say for someone that they have lost. That prayer can only be said with a minyan of 10 traditionally men, but nowadays in egalitarian settings, men and women. So you need at least 10 people there to say the Kaddish, and you try to say the Kaddish at least two or three times a day. So there are prayer services that are actually held in the home of the mourner. After the 7 days, the person can go back to work, go back to wherever they lived. They get back into public again, but there's a period of 30 days called Shloshim, in which the traditionally observant person will not go to parties, will not go to weddings, will not go to concerts, but will, you know, begin to go back to work again. And then people typically say the mourner's prayer for 11 months following the death of someone close to them. And they would say it in synagogue, go to synagogue and say this mourner's prayer for 11 months. And at that point, the period of mourning is over, except for the lighting of that candle that you would do forever. As long as somebody still remembers that person, they will light a memorial candle for them on that particular date. I want to make a mention about a very, very moving experience I had when I went to Israel, where my husband and I went on our honeymoon. And having been Roman Catholic, I had to go on the Way of the Cross. The Way of the Cross. I just had to do that. I thought it was going to be a really neat experience. So I took the tour of the Way of the Cross, and at the end of the Way of the Cross, you get into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Have any of you been this? So you know what I'm talking about. And the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, I mean, it sounds like it's huge, but it's really, I mean, where the stations are, the Way of the Cross and that Holy Sepulchre Church, are they right on top of each other. I was surprised at kind of how confined everything was. But I got to the point where, and please, if I'm getting my order wrong, because it's been a number of years since I've done the Way of the Cross, but I think there's a point where Jesus is taken down off the cross and he was bathed. Am I saying that correctly? He was bathed. And there's a stone in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre which shows the place where he was laid to be bathed. And I stood in front of that stone and I started to cry, because that stone was the Tahara place. And Jesus had been taken down and bathed in the ritual Jewish fashion. And that's what the bathing was. It was Tahara. used probably by six or seven faithful Jews in the community, bathed him, wrapped him in the white shroud. And in Israel, they don't bury underground, so he was put in a cave immediately. Do you remember how quickly that was? So it was the very traditional Jewish practice. And so for me, that's as you said, I saw the two traditions coming together right there in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So it was a beautiful experience. I just wanted to end with that because I do think we have so much in common. And while these rituals of blood and water seem so strange, in fact, our traditions are linked through those traditions of blood and water. I think you, the Christians, have gone more in the direction of the water, but that came out of the Jewish tradition. It's interesting that the Christians abandoned the blood side of it very, very clearly. Jesus got rid of that practice of circumcision almost right off the bat. I mean, I think there might have been a short period of time, and I'm not a scholar in early church history, but I think the practice of circumcision was abandoned pretty early in the Christian church. And that was in great part because they wanted to bring in people who weren't Jewish. And like I said, these rituals, I mean, drawing of the blood, the circumcision, it's painful. It gets you right here. And it's maybe easier to abandon these rituals that really kind of get to the core of things that have to do with pain and blood and that sort of thing. Can absolutely understand why Jesus made that cutoff and said, we will not require anybody to be circumcised. We will have them go through the mikvah, which is, you know, the second part of that conversion process, and which also comes out of the ancient Jewish tradition. So thank you all. I've gone over again. I'm sorry. Thank you all for coming and for dealing with me in this very difficult section. They're all easier after this.
You know, I'd like to say something before we go. I was talking to somebody the other day who was getting really impatient with this blood theology, the blood of the cross, and being there's a hymn about. I forget. Does anybody know?
The loss in the blood.
There's another one.
Power in the blood.
Drawn from Emmanuel's veins.
Yes, that's washing the blood.
Is that washing the blood?
Yeah.
And sort of, they wanted to get rid of this blood theology.
Mm-hmm.
What you've done for me now is you've given me a whole new appreciation of how significant blood is. And we should maybe go back and rethink our aversion to the blood theology and perhaps come to a new appreciation of it via the things that you've told us about circumcision and about the moment of blood on the clothing, you know, at
mm-hmm.
time of death. All of these things are very moving to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. I mean, talking about blood is very moving, and talking about water, it's so elemental. I mean, these are very elemental things. But I mean, I have to go back and say, you must understand that many of these traditions are being abandoned by Jews as well, because they are uncomfortable. They're difficult.
It's interesting that John says at the time of Jesus' death, you know, they poke a spear in his side, and out comes blood
mm-hmm.
and water.
Mm-hmm.
So even there, the two words are brought right together.
I had, you know, and I had forgotten the whole part about the crucifixion, where blood really is a big, you know, it is a big part of, and the crown of the thorns with
right.
the blood. So yes, it's true. Blood did find its way back into Christian tradition again. Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's a big one.
Thank you.
As